This is SG2 Perspectives, a conversation with industry experts and SG2 thought leaders about the biggest trends in healthcare and what we all expect that's going to mean for the future of healthcare delivery.
The main reason for those that responded with a positive acceleration impact, they truly saw the value of capitation and prospective revenue models in an environment where we have declining or unpredictable volumes. Predictability creates stability. So I think that's really helpful to prioritize investments, create budgets in the industry. And so people are understanding the value of that type of payment model, which comes along with the transition of value.
Hello, and welcome to SG2 Perspectives. I am your host, Kelly Richard. Today's topic is the impact of COVID-19 on the shift to value-based care. I have with me Jim Riley, Senior Principal and leader of our value-based care consulting practice, and Brian Esser, Associate Principal on our intelligence team and value-based care expert. Thank you both for being here today.
Thanks for having us, Kelly.
My pleasure, Kelly.
There's been a lot of discussion around the impact of COVID-19 on the shift to value. Do you think the pandemic is accelerating or decelerating the shift to value?
Yeah, Kelly, this is Jim. It has been our sense that COVID-19 and the factors and drivers that the pandemic has brought to the industry would accelerate this transition to value in our industry. So we actually took that question to some of our members to get their perspective. We talked to 24 unique health systems in a variety of roles, administrative, financial, clinical. And 20 out of the 24 health systems responded as the COVID-19 pandemic would accelerate the transition to value, which validated our sense and our opinion that it would be accelerated. The main reason for those that responded with a positive acceleration impact, they truly saw the value of capitation and prospective revenue models in an environment where we have declining or unpredictable volumes. Predictability creates stability. So I think that's really helpful to prioritize investments, create budgets in the industry. And so people are understanding the value of that type of payment model, which comes along with the transition of value. And the second most frequent reason given for a positive acceleration was concern that fee-for-service just doesn't provide incentive for lowering costs or coordinating care, which is critical to eliminate wasteful healthcare. We'll probably see an acceleration to value as a result.
I think that's spot on. Kelly, I would look at it as well from maybe the revenue side of the equation, especially on the payment side. When you think about Medicare itself, the urgency around shifting to alternative payment models and the idea of shifting risk essentially to providers seems to have gained a certain level of urgency as well. And part of that's just based on Medicare funding itself. With unemployment where it's at, deferrals of payroll taxes, overall funding and the Medicare trust fund itself, previous to this, 2026 was our date for that being depleted or being insolvent. The idea that COVID has accelerated that timeline is probably accurate, maybe by a couple years. So we're thinking Medicare itself has much more interest in shifting away from fee-for-service, be it alternative payment models and or increased enrollment in Medicare Advantage. And then I think the employers themselves as well. Obviously, driving the commercial insurance business, all have been impacted, various industries more so than others. But we know all the employers are seeking to lock in the savings they somewhat witnessed during the pandemic. Health spending was down across the employee bases as employees were stuck at home, deferring elective surgeries, and the employers themselves saw a drop in their overall health spend. And now they're seeking new ways to lock in that spending moving forward. So I think the revenue side is also very keen on the idea of value and will push new models like capitation. And then maybe more simple models of narrow networks or direct-to-employer type bundles are going to come back to the forefront.
Right. And I want to push a little bit on part of that because we're talking about the cost of healthcare being really high, both on the Medicare side as well as on the employer side. But capitation is a fairly mature model, and some organizations probably just aren't ready to go there. Are you seeing a difference between organizations that are ready to do this and then others that maybe just aren't ready at all?
There are organizations that aren't ready for that type of risk in our industry. They're largely working in fee-for-service environments and markets and likely don't have the competencies, data, and alignment with their networks to make it successful. we don't think health systems have to evolve quickly to this integrated Kaiser model or take on full cap risk out of the gate. In our industry today, there are several stair-step opportunities and voluntary opportunities to gain competencies, gain experiences, and move in this direction. With the financial troubles on the horizon, you'll see the continued rollout of voluntary alternative payment models, and many of which are episodic in nature or total cost of care in nature. And in 2021, now we'll have a capitated-based direct contracting model rolled out by CMMI, which also gives you different levels of risk to take on. It would probably be a mistake for everybody to move in that direction at 100 miles an hour. There are ways to get there in time to do so in a meaningful way, a thoughtful way, and a financially prudent way as well. That's where things are headed to create the predictability and spend for employers as well as providers, given the volatile nature of healthcare that we've seen over decades.
Capitation in itself brings a lot of risk to a provider, but the idea of segmenting that capitation out is maybe not total cost of care cap, but primary care capitation seems to be much more interesting across the board, even from providers that historically have avoided that. And I think part of that is just seeing the interruption to business for these primary care clinics and the idea that virtual health is taking off and the payment around that may be uncertain moving forward. We know that that clinic space is going to be used some way, and capitating that environment and making it at least more predictable and a primary care basis is of interest to more providers than it ever was. And to Jim's point, direct contracting capitated for traditional Medicare fee-for-service population, but within the model itself, you could have direct contracting entities agree to take that capitation, but not all the preferred providers within the model itself necessarily need to go full cap. There's ways to broker partnerships that may make sense for those willing to take on risk and those that may not be.
Maybe we should just start calling it prospective payment instead of capitation to sell it a little bit more easily so people aren't as nervous about the level of risk that they would have in a traditional capitation payment model.
Yeah, I think it's a good way to think about it, Kelly.
I totally agree, Jim. That decision point of, is value the game I want to play? There's no reason to say we have to do this. You know, fee-for-service is still a viable business model, but making that cultural decision and taking on everything that entails, from infrastructure investment to the way you just view the entire continuum of care, is going to be critical. And some of the systems we have been talking to, in addition to all the contracting and revenue sort of decision points on payment, it's at the end of the day, I have to deal with everything coming out of CMS, be it from price transparency, which is going to start in January, and what will that do to the market, to 340B cuts, to inpatient-only list being removed, potentially. All of these different things start to become less of an issue if you say, I'm going to take on full risk. I'm ready to go that way and play that game. So it's how much are you willing to take from the payment side and all the changes and rules versus saying, I want to own my care delivery model and how we get paid moving forward. If you make that decision, there's a few different ways to think through that. Either you build it all, or there's also the potential of partner. We're seeing disruptors in the market who are very good at total care risk. Third parties, we've seen them come in and partner with different systems, as well as segments of care delivery that industry is continually asking to come up to the table and help support some of this value transition, be it with diabetic populations or certain chronic illnesses that they want to come to the table and partner with systems. So once you make that decision, there's opportunities to think broadly about who are my real partners out there and how do I let you leverage their skill sets to advance quickly.
Brian, those are some great points about partnerships. I heard both of you mention scenario planning here. We do have an election coming up, and I'm just wondering if you could anticipate what the outcome of the shift to value will be based on that. And just to keep in mind, SG2 is a nonpartisan organization.
Kelly, it's hard enough to predict day to day with these two campaigns and these two administrations, let alone what's going to happen after November 3rd. Here's some things that we think will be true. Don't see either candidate or administrations moving to a Medicare for all. Both will support the transition to value, although it's likely to do it in different ways. For example, the Trump administration, I think there's a lack of satisfaction with the current models and the return to CMS for alternative payment models that are in place today. We would expect the Trump administration, should they be successful in November, to likely be more aggressive in the levels of risk tied to models that are rolled out, that generally drive care redesign and savings for those efforts. It's also likely to predict possibly that there'll be fewer models. We won't have such a large menu of options. Fewer models, more aggressive in the terms of prospective revenue or risk, rolling out to get the returns and the value of true care redesign. with the Biden administration, many of the original architects of the Affordable Care Act in 2010 are likely to be part of his team rolling out healthcare policy, probably an upgrade on existing and planned APMs. So the terms make more sense with the industry conditions and the factors today. There are a lot of terms that don't make a lot of sense in the shared savings program, the bundled payment for care improvement program. And frankly, we haven't seen enough detail on the upcoming direct contracting and primary care first. And so there's a real opportunity to upgrade those terms to get the kind of behavior and outcomes that we want. I think the Biden administration may roll forward with the current menu of APMs.
I agree with everything you said, Jim. I think it's sort of those two different approaches, one probably more market-driven with the current administration, one probably more ACA and CMMI-driven with the current models for a potential Biden administration. The only thing I would throw out is we can't forget that the ACA itself will be at the Supreme Court, I think, end of this year, early next year, and a decision will have to be made whether it remains or not, but would give whatever administration's in power the ability to maybe think differently around healthcare and how it's delivered in America.
We've just focused quite a bit on Medicare, and I think that that's usually where we start when we're thinking about where organizations should begin moving to value. But the employer space, particularly the employer as a payer, represents really an under-leveraged market power. Do you think COVID-19 will change that? Are you seeing more agency among employers in shifting the commercial population to value?
This is a big issue. And for those that choose fee-for-service and the status quo, probably their biggest risk factor tied to that will be how are employers going to behave and drive healthcare reform. They will be driving healthcare reform through alternative payment models and new delivery models. There seems to be a lack of patience to wait for health system delivery change, and employers are seeing the opportunity to implement things such as virtual and digital care solutions, their own care navigation, concierge services to employees and beneficiaries, implementing high-performing networks in their markets, as well as center of excellence programs for their employees and beneficiaries, capturing the spend levels they've experienced over the last two quarters, added to their own financial challenges as a result of COVID-19, are going to bring healthcare spend to the forefront. They're tired of waiting for the system reform, and we'll start to see them drive this change. This is going to be a big strategic issue in most markets.
Kaiser puts out their employer health benefits survey every year. And from the last recession, the 08, 09, you did see employers looking at narrow networks, centers of excellence, bundles, and you saw that creep up. And then as the unemployment rate started to drop, competition for labor became more intense. That seemed to wane a bit because they knew they had to open up some of the networks and give employees more choice. I think that's going to reverse quite again. They're trying to limit that spend, but they want to do it in a way that also keeps the employee base happy and makes them feel comfortable. And virtual is going to play a huge part of that. And moving forward, they're going to be looking, how do I lock in my savings while keeping my employees feeling as though I'm giving them the best benefit structure possible? And that's where these direct to employer offerings are really thinking more creatively as a provider of how do I make myself accessible both in person and virtually and really make these employers understand that I'm doing everything I can to give them the best value overall. While making their employees happy and keeping them healthy so they can be as productive as possible is going to be key. So a lot more to come there, but I think this is a under-leveraged segment just due to the fractured nature of employers, and it's not always going to be those large employers driving it. You have to focus on the medium and small as well.
There's a vehicle through third-party administrators in many markets that are forming or very active that are aggregating smaller and mid-sized employers. This will make it easier for employers to gain access to networks, gain access to alternative payment models and rates that keep spend in check. As those administrators gain traction, build an aggregated base of employers, the stakes are going to rise for providers who can meet those demands, challenges. We'll have to be very careful that this not become a race to the bottom price-wise. Employers and administrators need to be educated on what value really is, what quality really looks like. And if our members and our industry don't drive that, I'm fearful that administrators and employers will. It's going to be a fascinating evolution within that segment. And I think our health system members need to be proactive in meeting those needs and maybe even driving how these relationships should form.
That's a great point. This is certainly an area where non-health system players are coming in and being really aggressive. And I don't know that direct-to-employer arrangements actually really work if they're not value-based. And I think that's something that we don't always get to because we're thinking about the consumer-driven aspect of it. But employers are the payer. They need lower cost. They need higher quality. And that's the value equation. These are the concepts that I think that we think about from a perspective of populations that we don't get very good reimbursement for. But even on the commercial side, if we don't approach this from a value-based perspective, the employer is not going to get what they're hoping for from the arrangement.
A perfect example of that, Kelly, is appropriateness. While one health system may have a higher cost to an employer for an event, it could be that the utilization for that event is half as likely versus another system. On a per cost basis, one system may look higher, but in the end, we've got to think about this long term over a continuum, look at appropriate measures, evaluate spend after they leave the health system, readmission rates, and that's when employers will truly get value.
Health systems really need to be able to track this and be able to show from a data perspective the value that they're able to provide for employers. Are you seeing any interesting partnerships to better collect and really display the value through data?
Yeah, we're starting to see systems themselves are building out their own data warehousing and interoperable tools to bring EMRs and all kinds of different data sets together. But often they're going to run into just the ability to invest enough to get that data to talk in a meaningful way at the point of care where it's actually needed. Industry partners that SG2 works with on the data side are really coming in and saying, hey, we understand your call centers, your EMR, artificial intelligence, customer management resources, and we have the ability to bring that all into a functional dashboard that the clinical and administrative business side can look at and provide meaningful value to your segments of customers in a differentiated way. And that level of data sophistication is just often not, unless you're a Kaiser or a Geisinger or some of these large systems, your average system doesn't have enough capital right now, especially with revenue being down, to invest in that kind of data infrastructure. But that's the data infrastructure that consumers and employers are expecting. They want to be able to go on their app and understand what's the wait time, where's my physician? Where's my test result? What should I be thinking through? And if we can get to that level of data, relevancy, and probably with a partner who understands that meaningful way, that's how you can really jumpstart your value equation and hold yourself out to the market and say, here's not just my clinical results, but here's how easy I am to use across all my different points of care along the continuum. And you really want to create that ecosystem. That's the key. And that's where all this data and synergizing it together is going to be a big differentiator.
Most systems that we are talking to are really at this point where they're strategizing about what they're going to do for the next 18 months. And given that predicted acceleration toward value-based care, what do you think are the key decisions that need to be made in the immediate time frame?
I think step one is for organizationally make the decision that we're moving to value or not. Perhaps fee-for-service is the model that has worked for you and is going to continue to work for you, you believe, for the next decade, then sort of that decision tree ends. The commitment from the organization to move to value is important to establish. Then if the answer to that is yes, look to reset your strategy to thoughtfully move in that direction. Key components of that strategic planning and analysis include evaluating competencies and your gaps in what it takes to succeed in prospective revenue models. It's important to create financial scenarios under certain assumptions about the pace to which we move. Now, a great example of that is the site of care shifts. We're going to be seeing that even absent value-based care arrangement with payers. But there's an example that if we're evolving our payer terms while we're experiencing inpatient to outpatient, outpatient to ASC shifts, the financial implications are significant and could be to your benefit to evolve your payer arrangement. Another thing we tell health systems is a no-regret move now is it's cost reduction. It really never goes out of style. If your system is not in best in class, top decile in cost per case, discharge destination, and appropriateness metrics, there's work to be done today that you'll receive the benefits of down the road. that is an appropriate and benefiting strategy for health system. And then thirdly, I would add these voluntary CMMI alternative payment models are a great way to further education and gain experience about what it takes to succeed in a total cost of care relationship or prospective revenue relationships, as well as the cost of your own employees, perhaps. So there are populations in Medicare fee-for-service through voluntary programs or your own employees where you could implement care redesign and other delivery strategies to gain experience in moving in this direction. So those might be some ideas over the next 18 months for some of our members.
Great. Well, thank you both for joining me today. If you like what you're hearing, please also listen and subscribe to our colleague, Dr. Tom Villanueva's Modern Practice podcast on Vizient's Medical Leadership Channel. Tom discusses key healthcare trends through the clinical leadership lens. You can find it wherever you listen to podcasts. Thank you for listening and stay healthy.
This has been another great episode of SG2 Perspectives, where industry experts and SG2 thought leaders explore the drivers of tomorrow's healthcare strategies to inform today's decision makers. Contact us anytime by sending an email to sg2perspectives@sg2.com. We'd love to hear from you. SG2 revolutionized healthcare demand forecasting with the Impact of Change forecast, and today we're the industry's premier strategy advisory firm. To learn more, visit sg2.com. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you again soon.